Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's a midday magazine for Wednesday, August 26, 2015. I'm Joe Vicnicki with the local news. The deadline has passed and 16 people have filed paperwork to get their names on the Petersburg Borough ballot for the October 6 election. That means voters will be filling 15 of the 21 open seats on the ballot this October. There are two takers for the two seats on the Borough Assembly. Eric Castro has filed for a three-year term, along with incumbent Nancy Strand. There was no other interest in the Assembly seats, so those two will start up three-year terms in October. There is one contested race on the ballot. That's for the Harbor Board. Three people have filed for two seats there. Bob Martin, John Mergus, and Jim Stromdahl are seeking a three-year term on the Harbor Board, and voters will choose a two of the three. Marlene Cushing and Chris Tinas are running for re-election to the Hospital Board. Two seats on that board had no candidates filing. Chelsea Tremblay is running for a three-year term on the Library Board. There's also one seat there with no interest. And four people are running for one of the six open seats on the Planning and Zoning Commission. Richard Burke, David Kensinger, Otis Marsh, and Tom Stearns are running unopposed for two or three-year terms. Two terms of 1 year had no interest. On the Public Safety Board, Gina Mucci is running for a one-year term, and one seat has no candidate. And the School Board will have a full roster, with incumbents Cheryl File, Jay Lister, and Mara Lutomsky all running to keep their seats. The six seats that have no interest can be filled by appointment by the Borough Assembly at a later date. Also, borough residents can still run as write-in candidates by filing a letter of interest. The deadline for those letters is October 2nd at 5 p.m. In other news, the Alaska Marine Highway System will soon charge more for canceling reservations. The fee increase begins October 1st, at the same time the winter ferry schedule begins. That schedule, which reflects state budget cuts, was made public today. The new fees range from 5 to 40% of a ticket's value, depending on the time until travel begins. Those booking more than a month in advance and canceling within a day face no fees. Current policy charges a 15% fee for cancellations made within 2 weeks of sailing. A ferry press release says no-shows and canceled tickets cost the system money. The closer a cancellation to sailing, the harder it is to resell that ticket. After months of delays, a new ferry in Southeast is planning to start up service this Friday. The Rainforest Islands Ferry will run four-day-a-week service connecting Petersburg, Wrangell, and Kaufman Cove on Prince of Wales Island. Here's more in this report. The small community of Kaufman Cove has been planning for the restart of ferry service to Northeast Prince of Wales Island for years. One resident, Heather Hedges, works in marketing for the new ferry and says the boat arrived in that town on Friday.
I think we all had tears in our eyes. We were all very excited to see it. They came in Friday night, and, of course, we all hung out and waited for them to come in with anticipation, and it was just really nice to see it come in.
The community of 174 people lost ferry service in 2009 when another independent ferry authority ended its service between Kaufman Cove, Wrangell, and the southern end of Mitkoff Island near Petersburg. This new converted landing craft will be restarting a four-day-a-week connection on that route. Hedges says the ferry is better than she expected.
The seats are really comfortable. It's got a very small galley. However, we're going to have some good food on there, so we're pretty excited about that. So, yes, it's a very nice boat.
The Rainforest Islands Ferry has capacity for up to 28 passengers and 6 vehicles. It had been scheduled to start up its service in mid-June, but was delayed multiple times, waiting for certification from the Coast Guard and overcoming a mechanical problem. The ferry's general manager, Kent Miller, says he hopes all the delays are behind them.
We've gotten the certificate of inspection for the vessel, so we're able now to start carrying passengers. And that certainly is a milestone that the overhaul and refit of the boat has been invested in. So we're glad to get to that point. Now all we have to do is show everyone that we can operate reliably and make money in winter. And so obviously there are challenges ahead, but that's the next step.
The 65-foot ferry was scheduled to do a dry run on the route this week. The launch of passenger service is planned for Friday, August 28th, and the organization is calling to schedule passage with people who have expressed interest in riding on the new ferry. And while the ferry is scheduled to run Friday, the planned mini-coach service from the three docking sites is not expected to be ready until later next month. That service will help get people from remote boat ramps at Shoemaker Bay south of Wrangell and Banana Point south of Petersburg to those communities. The van service is also planned between Kaufman Cove and Craig on Prince of Wales Island. Miller says the authority has ordered three passenger vans and hopes to have those in place by September 20th. In addition, he says the ferry authority is looking into adding a fourth stop on its route at Roosevelt Harbor on Zarembo Island.
We haven't been in there, obviously, but the dry run will take a look at Roosevelt Harbor as well for a service that can provide hunters and off-road vehicles and recreational opportunity.
Once it gets going, the ferry will be running Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. The grand opening for the new service is also expected to be announced in the next few weeks. In other news from around Southeast, search crews recover the final victim of the August 18th Sitka landslide. The body of 62-year-old William Stortz was found yesterday afternoon at around 4:15. Heavy equipment operators had been working at several locations identified by search dogs. A road was built up to the observation area at the south end of the slide, and a plywood boardwalk installed to improve the mobility of search crews on the ground. Searchers were under pressure to take advantage of two good days of good weather before more rain is expected to arrive tomorrow. Now that all the victims are found, city officials in Sitka estimate at least another 30 days of work to clear Kramer Avenue. Municipal Administrator Mark Gorman was a longtime friend of Stortz, who served as Sitka's building official since 2011. In a press release, Gorman writes that Stortz was a hardworking, intelligent, and very kind man. He died in the August 18th slide along with brothers Elmer and Ulysses Diaz, who were painting a new house in the Kramer subdivision, and services are planned for this week in Sitka. Among all the expertise imported to Sitka to aid in recovery operation at the Kramer Avenue slide, one man finds this disaster very close to home. Thomas Richardson is a battalion chief with the Seattle Fire Department. 17 months ago, he stood over a similar scene in Oso, Washington.
Yeah, it's very similar. In fact, it's deja vu. Both the techniques that they're using and the conditions that they're encountering are almost identical to what we had. Logs, broken trees, mud flow in the middle. It's with near quicksand-like conditions. And the techniques that they're choosing to use to do the searches are very similar to what we've done also.
The Oso slide was much larger. It covered about a square mile, and all 43 people lost their lives in that event in March of 2014. Richardson does not consider himself an expert in landslide recovery. He says the Seattle Fire Department just applied the skills they had to a difficult situation, and Sitka is doing the same thing.
Most people don't have a lot of experience. We didn't have any experience responding to landslides. We've had, you know, our usual small slides in the city that we responded to in the past that usually did damage to structures but didn't trap a lot of people. Oso was by far the biggest one that, you know, any of us had ever encountered.
Richardson will be in Sitka for 2 days while the clearing work continues. He will be observing the use of a special pump that's being flown in by the Coast Guard used for the removal of mud. British Columbia Minister of Mines Bill Bennett is in Juneau and Ketchikan this week talking about projects on rivers that crossed the border into southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld sat down for a one-on-one interview with Bennett to get his response to some of the controversies that brought him here. That includes tailings dams. Critics point to last year's breach at eastern BC's Mount Pauley mine, which sent water, silt, and metals into nearby waterways. They say it's an example of what could go wrong at other mine sites and cite a technical report that brings up dry tailings storage as an alternative. In the interview, Bennett says that report has been misunderstood.
Well, unfortunately, when the independent panel came out with their report, in January of 2015, in the section of the report where they make recommendations around the use of best available technology, they used an example of best available technology, and that was dry stack tailings, and they made reference to the Greens Creek mine here in Alaska. And when I say unfortunate, not really unfortunate from my perspective, but unfortunate from the perspective of the three geotechnical experts who were on the panel, I've since received a letter from one of those experts. He's the head of the mine engineering faculty at the University of British Columbia. His name is Dirk Van Zeel. He has a PhD in geotechnical engineering, essentially saying, you know, best available, and I'll quote, best available technology is not a single technology. There is a selection that has to take place that you base on site-specific risk management process. In other words, you're looking at what kind of rock there is at the mine, for example. If it's potentially acid-generating, there may, in fact, be a need to put that rock underwater so that the acid is neutralized. That is not dry stack. That's the more traditional method of managing tailings. So, unfortunately, there is a sense or an impression out there that dry stack tailing is the only way to get best available technology, and that's just not the case.
Is it the conclusion in your agency that what happened at Mount Polley was site-specific, that the problems with what was under the dam and the angle of the dam and the amount of water was really the problem, and that's not something that's going to be repeated elsewhere?
I don't think we would take the position that, you know, it's not possible for that sort of accident to happen anywhere else, because the independent panel stated the cause of the accident was a failure by the original design engineers to pick up on the fact that there was this unstable material underneath the foundation of the dam. So the original design didn't account for that unstable material, and you know, theoretically, human error can happen in any situation. So what we're doing is we're working with the engineering profession, with the mining industry, with the universities and so forth, to reduce the risk from the way that we design and apply our policy and the way we design and apply our regulations. So you can actually increase what's known as the factor of safety and decrease the factor of risk by taking certain actions.
So the new standards being developed, or updated standards, will those be required of mines that have already been permitted but the building hasn't started?
The short answer is yes. If a mine has not been constructed yet, they will absolutely have to comply with the new regulations. But we will follow the advice of the independent panel in the sense that mines that already exist have to depend on best practices and more supervision, more inspections, and that's already in place. We put that in place within 6 months of this accident. So we think we have responded to the Mount Polley accident in a very robust and responsible way. Mount Polley is not part of a pattern of bad behavior, as some folks have suggested. We have a good record in the province aside from Mount Polley. We just need to make sure that it never happens again.
The dry stack tailings option, is there a place for that in BC mines? Do you see a situation where that would be advantageous?
Dry stack tailings will be incorporated in some of the new projects in BC, I have no doubt. The way it's going to work, again, we're following the advice of the independent panel. We require companies now to show us that they have considered all of the best available technologies for tailing storage. We've always done that in the past, but now we are holding their feet to the fire a little more, to the extent that we want the detail. We want you to show us how you examine the relative merits of various ways of managing tailing. So if you say to us, oh no, dry stack doesn't work for us, fair enough, but you have to prove to us that that is in fact the case. And cost cannot be the only driving factor in this. As the panel said, you know, there cost can't drive values and protection of the environment.
The groups on this side of the border that are expressing their concerns or opposition talk about the issue with tailings dams and how long they can last. Are you confident that these tailings dams can be built to last hundreds, if not thousands, of years?
I think there's a misperception that when a tailings storage facility is approved, that designed tailings storage facility is going to have to last in perpetuity. When a mine is approved, and I know the rules are the same here in the U.S. as they are in Canada, the mining company has to include a plan for closure and for remediation. So typically what happens is over a period of time, those tailing storage facilities get capped with impervious material. A plan is made for dealing with water that runs over the site in the future, and those dams are not left to stand forever and ever holding back water. That's not typically what happens.
That was British Columbia Minister of Mines Bill Bennett being interviewed by Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld during a visit to Southeast to discuss transboundary mines. We'll hear more from mine critics during future reports. For KFSK News, I'm Joe Vicnicki. Coming up on KFSK, Street Beat Music with Chuck Rose, and at 2:30, it's Sideline Sports, The High Country with Pat Hind at 2:40, All Things Considered at 4 o'clock with local news and updated weather at 4:30, and Alaska News Nightly on at 6 o'clock, followed by Ebb Tide Music with Chelsea Tremblay at 6:30. Mike Flynn, your host for Folk Sampler at 9 o'clock, and 10 o'clock with Radio Free Petersburg, your host Ben Wasilowski for that show. Coming up next, we'll take a look at the weather forecast and the community calendar messages.